Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Welcome to Gabfest Reads, a monthly series from the Political Gabfest. I'm David Plotz, and this month I'm super happy to talk with my friend Florence Williams, who's the author of Heartbreak, A Personal and Scientific Journey, which is out this month. Hi, Florence.
Hello, David. I'm so honored and pleased to be your guinea pig for this series. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're always good on self-experimentation, so it'll be... It'll be good to self-experiment with this podcast form. And what's more, Florence, you've done an amazing enhanced audiobook with my old colleague Jacob Weisberg over at Pushkin with notes, audio notes that you took as you were reporting and interviews with people. And what else is in that?
Yeah, we slid in actual tape from some of my therapy sessions, and some of it's pretty raw. It features material that's not in the book.
And the interview with the one of the guys you rebounded with a little bit.
Yes. Oh, yes. He is heavily featured, in fact.
Yeah. So I want to give a little bit of background on Florence. So Florence is a science journalist, a very distinguished science journalist. She's based here in Washington, D.C., like me, although we're in different rooms. And she is the author of two celebrated earlier books, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, and The Nature Fix. And I wanted to have her on this month because Heartbreak is a very personal book. It's a very personal book, obviously, for Florence, as she will talk about. It's also personal for me because, Florence, you're a friendly acquaintance who became a real friend as you were working on this book because you were going through a heartbreak. You were sort of maybe a year ahead of me on the heartbreak train as I was going through a heartbreak, as my heartbreak was beginning. We both, as I said, live here in Washington. We both saw 20-plus year marriages collapse at kind of unexpectedly around us, and you were a guide and counselor to me. You know, there's a way to the other side for most of us, and I want to hope that you can be a figure of hope and possibility for Gabfest listeners who might be having distress now because of a loss of love. So it's a big task. It's a big responsibility for you.
It is. Well, I hope so too. And I hope it was helpful to you, and I hope it will be helpful to others.
All right. I'm sure it will. So, all right, let's get to the basics. So you've written a book called Heartbreak. It's personal and scientific. Get the quick and dirty. What is your heartbreak? And what is heartbreak anyway?
I think heartbreak can have a wide definition, and I try to sort of nod to that in the book, because I think certainly right now we can all argue that we're going through a sort of collective heartbreak in a time of grief and struggling with loneliness, you know, collectively. But I do, of course, focus mostly on romantic heartbreak. That is the particular earthquake, you know, that I was experiencing. And actually, it started before the pandemic, for which I was grateful in some ways. And I think it would be interesting to talk about that, how heartbreak sort of prepared us, you know, for the uncertainties of the pandemic. But my particular heartbreak, I guess, really began one evening, 25 years into marriage, when I happened upon an email that my then husband wrote, sort of professing his love for another woman.
What percent of heartbreak do you think in this era begins with happening upon an email? It must be, or text. I think more likely a text message.
I think
it must
be
like 98%.
A huge percentage.
Lock your phones, friends.
Just in my defense, I want to say I was not snooping. My then husband actually handed me his phone, and he said, "Here's an email about my dad." And lo and behold, there was a very different email on there.
That's the trigger. But what is the heartbreak?
That was the trigger. It really starts with this moment, I think, of shock. Then it progresses to this kind of, you know, disbelief and denial and sort of, you know, a certain amount of rage and upset. And then, you know, real grief. and the feelings of rejection and humiliation, you know, that go along with that. And then, you know, I think it risks progressing into loneliness. And I think, you know, for me, it definitely did to an extent. And then, you know, sort of how long that loneliness lasts is a really big question in terms of what I really talk about a lot in the book, which are the health effects of this kind of heartbreak.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I was going back and looking at my notes in the book, and like, and it's almost like the worst doctor's visit ever. That every page you have something like heartbreak is worse than smoking for your health, or divorce is a greater risk factor for death than smoking. Fatigue, anxiety, poor impulse control, depression, cognitive decline, early death are all impacts of this. So talk a little bit about what does heartbreak do that just sort of like being bummed does not do.
Yeah, and this was a huge surprise to me. And, you know, part of why I thought maybe there was a book here, I was so surprised to learn. I think we all tend to think of heartbreak as existing sort of in our heads. You know, it's this emotional calamity. And yet, it turns out it has these really direct impacts on our immune systems, on our nervous systems, literally the way our white blood cells get reproduced in our bone marrow, and which is, you know, a sort of rabbit hole that I go down quite a bit in the book. And that, you know, increased inflammation in our body caused by the feelings of grief and threat and so on can have really serious implications.
You talk in the book about how you lost all this weight. And I just remember, I mean, for me, it was the not sleeping. Like, that was what I found absolutely murderous. Yes. I went through a period of about a year where I didn't get a single good night's sleep. I mean, I would get high sometimes just to, that would like get me to sleep. But man, I just couldn't stay asleep. It was so terrible.
It's brutal. One of the first people I interviewed when I didn't even know I was writing a book yet was this biological anthropologist, Helen Fisher, who writes a lot about what happens to your brain when you're falling in love. And she's one of the few people who's actually kind of started to look at what happens on the other side of love, too. And, you know, the way she explained it really helped make sense to me, you know, that basically our stress hormones are just going nuts when our primary attachment partner has taken off, you know, and we've been used to having this person around, you know, for decades. Suddenly we do feel very, very alone, and our bodies, you know, from our sort of our deepest evolutionary pasts, consider that a major threat state. It's sort of like when we are preparing to be attacked by predators because we're suddenly not with our people.
Do you think that the dumper feels it? We're both kind of the dumpies.
The dumpies.
In our marriages.
Do you think
the dumper has this too?
The dumpies have been much more studied than the dumpers, but it looks like they have pretty different experiences. I think sometimes the dumper seems to sort of skate away, you know, into a state of sort of relief and happiness, sadly, for those of us who are the dumpies. But I don't think it's that simple. I think the dumpers also probably feel quite a lot of conflict and guilt, certainly. But I think they're also maybe better at compartmentalizing that and thinking everything's going to be just fine.
I mean, every person who's ever been in a marriage has said or had this said to them, well, you know, of course it's mediocre, of course it's blah, you just kind of got to endure this and get through it, and that you know, just soldier on through it. Is it healthier to soldier on through something that is blah, 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 or to go through, what's your take? Is heartbreak worse for you than mediocrity?
Every marriage goes through the blahs, you know. It seems to be better to be married than to be unmarried. But if you're in a bad marriage, you know, it gets a little bit iffier. Certainly to be single actually may be better than to be in a bad marriage, and certainly than being divorced maybe.
I mean, I have very few criticisms of your book. I think the one area you underplay, we haven't gotten to the areas that you play just right, but the one area you underplay, I think, is the financial impact of heartbreak or of divorce or of an end of a marriage. For most people, the financial impact is so profound that it basically is a health impact too, right?
Absolutely. And especially for women. Women who are divorced are more than twice as likely to live in poverty than men who are divorced. men do end up with the majority of assets after divorce, typically because they have higher earning power and they continue to have a higher earning power afterwards. So, I mean, the gender disparities actually were very fresh on my mind. To tell you the truth, I was a little bit careful about not talking about it more, sort of out of sensitivity to my ex-husband, who asked me not to talk about that too much. Right. I think it would make him look even worse, you know, than I. But absolutely. I mean, and I think that's why, frankly, a lot of professionals and college-educated people have much lower divorce rates, because there's this need to sort of protect the assets and because there are bigger financial implications of divorce.
Here you are. You're a woman in your late 40s, maybe early.
I was exactly on the brink of being 50.
So you're suddenly like despairing. You're losing weight. You're
freaked
out, terribly sad. And I think what's amazing about this book, as you say, a personal scientific journey, is that like, when life gives you lemons, make content. You made a book, but you made a book by exploring yourself and trying to like set out to figure out like, what is it that I can do? I, Florence Williams, can do to make myself happier, to get through this. You try every fucking thing. What did you try? And I know some of it's research, but like every act was genuine.
When I found out how imperiled I was in terms of my health, there was this incredible urgency. I just felt like I needed to get better as quickly as I could. I tried mostly things that had some scientific evidence, you know, behind them. I debunked, actually, I think, quite a few myths that don't have so much science behind them. You know, there's a certain amount of pablum that we're told.
What?
Oh, like, you know, you shouldn't get in another relationship too soon. You know, you have to love yourself first before you can enter another relationship, and you have to be, you know, in a great place and already have done your growth. I've even heard that sometimes it's repeated that for every year of marriage, you should wait 6 months.
Right.
And I was like, forget it.
Right.
Like, I'm going
to
be...
What, to share Social Security?
I'm going to be spoon-fed by that. Like, that's just not going to happen. okay, so you want to know what I tried. So yes, I did try flinging myself, I think, into the arms of other relationships, which for me did provide a certain measure of comfort. I also, you know, I had written this book called The Nature Fix about how being in nature cures everything. So I was very invested in the idea that, God, if I just go hiking and rafting and into the woods, I'm going to feel so much better. And so I did a lot of that. It partly worked, but not completely. I tried psychedelics as kind of a breakup drug. You know, we sometimes hear of things like MDMA, ecstasy being used in couples counseling, but lately people are starting to talk about it also as a breakup drug. So I thought that was absolutely worth trying, did that.
What works?
Everything was slightly disappointing because nothing really was a magic bullet, of course. And that's, I think, the big lesson of heartbreak. You know, you don't really get to a destination. It's all sort of a process. The passage of time, you know, helps a lot. My friendships, huge help. I don't know if you found this, David, but I really felt like I had a really profound appreciation for my friends.
Yeah.
Not everyone. I mean, some people sort of disappear and fade away. But the ones who are there for you are really there for you. And boy, when you're feeling lonely and feeling your self-esteem sort of at rock bottom, to have your friends really come out of the woodwork and tell you how much they love you, I mean, that was some of the most powerful lessons of heartbreak that I received.
Yeah, I'm so with you on that. I remember, I think Emily Bazelon, fellow GabFest host, was maybe the first person outside of my immediate narrow circle, like my brother, who I told what was going on. And we were out for a walk in New York, and I was just weeping as we were walking through the streets of Manhattan. I don't even actually remember what her words were, but they were just so, like, so comforting, and so that sense of like, okay, well, with a friend like this, how bad can it be?
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
You know, that just stuck with me. You know what the first thing you said to me, just going back to friendships and also kind of the new relationships. After, I remember we had a first walk. It was like maybe in July of 2019 or something. I was newly separated, and we went out for a walk. And as I was saying goodbye, you said something like, "Don't get an STD." Or
yes.
that was your big advice.
And you should thank me for that.
It's true. Seriously, I actually want to get to to the sex piece of this, both for sort of personal prurient reasons, but also because I think it's really important, because I've spent so much time talking to men in particular who've just separated or like marriage is falling apart or whatever it is. Just the feeling of touch and sex and kind of like being desired. If you're coming off a period where you've felt undesired and where you felt, you know, bad about yourself, that makes an enormous difference.
Yeah, I mean, the science is really supportive of that on two fronts. Literally, it seems like certainly with men and probably with women too, who of course haven't been studied in this context, unfortunately, but your testosterone levels literally increase after divorce, which is really interesting, or after a split, I should say. And I think it's probably part of that threat response, you know, that your body goes into. You're sort of gearing up for a fight on some level. Your testosterone levels increase. That is going to actually increase your sex drive. There's a lot of science, too, about how one of the central ways that mammals, especially primates, calm our nervous systems is through touch. You know, it literally releases oxytocin.
Right. Right.
It releases these bonding hormones. It makes us feel safe. And it was really helpful to me that way.
Yeah. I certainly found like that sense, that touch, sex, touch, desire, being desired was, you know, it was just a huge mood elevator. And like it was, and it, even at a time when I felt like, oh, I know that I'm hiding from some of my grief through this. Like I realize that some of what I'm doing is like avoiding.
There's a distraction.
Deep despair quality. And distract. Yeah. I'm distracting myself on Tinder. I understood that I was doing that. At the same time, it felt really good. And I wonder, but maybe it's better for men, because it's just easier for men than it is for women to do that.
Plenty of women do that too. But I had a really interesting conversation with my therapist at one point. And I said, maybe for me, one of the things I was doing was I was traveling a ton. Like I was saying yes to every single speaking arrangement, every travel gig. That was kind of my distraction. Like I just needed to move, do stuff, work. And I said to my therapist, like, shouldn't I be just sitting still in my grief? Like, don't I need to feel this more? And she looked at me and she said, you know what? You are feeling it plenty. And she was right. I mean, I was still crying every day, you know, maybe for 5 minutes or, you know, maybe not all day. But the distraction piece doesn't totally work, because there's still plenty of grief that I'm sure you were experiencing.
Right. I do think that I'm wired. I don't know if you're wired this. I'm totally wired for like, well, if this is what I've been dealt, I'm just going to like make the most of it at least. You know, I'm so wired for action as opposed to inaction. And I'm an anti-introspective person for the most part. And
that's actually that is a psychologically healthy attitude.
I think it felt healthy. Like which made me ask myself, you do say there's some set of people who don't get beyond heartbreak. Who are they, and why does that happen?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of things that make a person less resilient, starting all the way with childhood trauma, you know, all kinds of things. But I think you're right that the introspection piece does seem to be in the profiles of people who kind of linger in their heartbreak longer. So this sort of ruminative personalities or introspective personalities. And I actually think I probably lean more toward that, actually. And those are the people who I think, you know, many, many months out are still replaying, you know, what went wrong, what happened, you know, what does it mean, what's my future? So I think I probably lean more towards the introspection category for sure.
And you think that, but what is the good of that? I mean, there are good things of that. It's not just like,
absolutely.
I was prolonging my misery. Like,
absolutely.
What are the good?
Well, I'd like to think that one is maybe art making. You know, we're the ones who can like provide some wisdom and some deep thinking about what this does mean, what it means for us and what it means for other people and what it means for our society. I think artists are known to be a little bit higher on the anxious neuroticism scale, perhaps. And maybe sometimes we sit in our pain a little bit longer.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I want to also talk about Trumes, because hopefully no officials of the Department of Justice are listening to this, but you were the person who kind of pointed me towards hallucinogens for myself too, which I, after you'd had an experience with shrooms, psilocybin, you pointed me, and I found it incredibly helpful. What's the case for MDMA or psilocybin or some mix of them for heartbreak?
Yeah, I mean, one of the first people I talked to was a psychologist at the University of Utah who said, we think that one of the keys to resilience is the ability to see beauty, the ability to feel awe. There's something about experiencing awe that actually, you know, pulls us out of our own kind of egos and our own problems, puts things into perspective, makes us feel more connected to other people. It's almost a sort of spiritual kind of concept, but I shudder to sort of use that word spiritual. But anything that I think makes us think that there are things beyond ourselves can do that. And so awe is a really essential emotion, actually, for that and for resilience. Then I talked to another psychologist. This is Dacher Keltner at the University of California, Berkeley, who writes, he's kind of the guy. He's the awe guy. He writes a lot about awe. You know, he's my age. He's got sort of long hair. He's, you know, looks kind of surfer groovy. At one point, I told him, I was interviewing him for something else. I told him about my split. And I said, you know, do you think I should try psilocybin? And he said, yes, absolutely you should. And I said, well, how can it help with heartbreak? And he said all those things. You know, it can kind of give you perspective, pull you out of your own funk, make you feel more connected, like make you less fearful. And certainly there is a lot of science showing that people, for example, with a terminal illness who take psilocybin become much less afraid of death and afraid of kind of their future. So with his, you know, sort of approval, I guess his stamp of approval, I decided to try it. And I was really careful. I interviewed different therapists. I wanted to find someone I could really trust, someone I could feel safe with. Because, you know, the thing about taking these psychedelics is you really do lose control of your mind. And I knew I wasn't very good at that and wasn't super comfortable with it. I wanted to find someone I really felt safe with. And so I did finally find someone. This was someone actually in Portland, Oregon. She's anonymous in the book for, you know, sort of obvious legal reasons. And I ended up having this really, really kick-ass, fantastic experience.
Yeah. Well, I'm so grateful to you.
How do you think it was helpful to you, David?
It was helpful to me. It was the unhappiest day of my life. You recall, because I called you afterwards. Do you remember this?
I
don't know if you remember.
I do.
I called you afterwards.
I was very curious.
It was the unhappiest day of my life. I had never been as sad as I was. And I was doing it in a group, and the other people in the group were extremely happy and extremely upbeat. And it was a real contrast of mood. But I think for me, it just the closest thing I can think of is sort of an accelerated therapy. It felt like 6 months of getting the sorrow. I mean, going back to what I was saying earlier about using sort of distraction to distract myself from the grief. And this was a way of directly facing the grief I felt and the sadness and the kind of the loss and the love that I felt for my ex-wife and how powerful that still was, and just like addressing it and seeing it was there and saying hello to it. And it was great. And I felt such an incredible sense of relief and
sounds like catharsis.
Yeah, it was cathartic. And also I loved the kind of psychedelic grooviness to it. Like the parts, you know, my notebook is filled with ruminations on the trees and the spider webs and stuff like that. So I love that part of it. But it was mostly the sorrow. And I'm such a smug, arrogant person. And a smug, arrogant person who mistook like great good fortune for virtue. And I feel like the sense of loss and of failure and of recognition of like that I hadn't done what I needed to do to keep my life going the way I wanted it to was humbling in the best possible way, and gave me a lot of sort of it just made me less of an asshole, probably.
Yes. Oh, I think heartbreak does that in general, you know, in the growth part of it. I think it does sort of increase your capacity for empathy and increase your capacity ultimately for love, you know, which is really what it's all about.
Do you think that that's like that heartbreak? Is it heartbreak that does that, grief that does that? Or I guess those are all tied together.
I think there is something particular about the heartbreak. It just sort of tears your identity down so deep that you have to kind of start back up again. When you're hurting that much, you are seeking out kind of other people who have also hurt. You know, there's this sort of secret society, a little bit of wisdom amongst people who have hurt a lot. And I think that you and I and, you know, a lot of, you know, successful professionals, I mean, we've been insulated from that kind of thing for a long time. And it does make us assholes for, you know, to some extent.
Right. Here you are, you're, what is it, 4 years?
I'm 4 years out, yeah.
Yeah. Is there any part of you, what part of this do you appreciate? Is there any part of you that's like, oh, well, this is good somehow?
Oh, yeah, a huge part of me thinks this is good. I feel like I am a more empathetic person. I feel like I think about and talk about and act out sort of how to be a better human, how to communicate. You know, I'm currently seeing someone, and I work really, really hard to figure out how to do better, how to be better at it this time around. And I think a lot of it has to do with vulnerability. You know, writing this book was a really vulnerable exercise, but being heartbroken is an exercise in vulnerability. And I think it has really just opened me up in some really profound ways that I'm very grateful for. There's something about just even the disclosing of this kind of vulnerability,
right,
that creates a space for intimacy that, you know, had been lacking, frankly, in my life. And now I'm at like an intimacy bunny. I just so groove on it. I love it.
Right. No, it's so funny. I mean, there's this line about, you know, men don't make friends after a certain point, that men have no friends, that men's friends only come through their family or through their spouse generally. And it's been such a revelation to have this possibility of friendship because of the possibility of intimacy and vulnerability. And there's so many people in my life who I am so much more deeply connected to because I've gone through this sorrow and they've helped me in some way, or I've helped them maybe because of they've had something similar in their life. And that's
exactly
what a great feeling that is.
And I think, you know, the emotional range that's implicit in that, you know, is so expanded. I think I used to sort of exist in this sort of narrow emotional range, and now it's really big. And because of that, the world is sort of italicized, you know? It's like the colors are brighter, the feelings are richer. I do feel more alive. It's been a really interesting experience.
Is there anything that's worse?
Oh, my financial state. my retirement fund. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm losing my house. I mean, you know, yeah, sure, that all of that. You know, you lose so much when you lose a long marriage. You lose a group of friends. You lose a sort of social status. There's a different way of moving through the world as an unattached person. And I miss some of the trappings of married life. You know, I miss that, you know, we both used to go to the parent-teacher conferences together, and we used to walk the dog together, and we had this certain expectations of, you know, how we were going to spend our years as we aged. There's a lot of loss there. And I still find myself sometimes dreaming about my ex. You know, I mean, he was such a part of my life from the time I was 18 years old. He's still a part of me, and I still... you know, there are still those adventures that I dream about, which is really, I think there's an element of loss still there.
Do you try to think about your past? You know, I've made a lot of progress, I think, and you know, I'm certainly in no sense the sorrowful person I was when this first started for me, but I do find it really hard to think about happy moments with my ex-wife. Like, even though I know there were tons of them, and I know that was a, you know, most of my adult life, but I just, like, don't kind of allow those memories to surface. And I feel that's probably a mistake somehow.
I can relate to what you're saying. I think I was like that for a while. But I'm getting over that. I now can sort of look at the photos, you know, from our river trips, you know, in our 20s and 30s, and look at them and not have just daggers, you know, in my eyes for my ex. I actually, there's a lot I still appreciate and love about who he was then. And I feel like I don't have regrets either about those years of marriage. Like, I'm really glad I had them. They were fun.
Right.
Until they weren't.
Right. Florence Williams' book is Heartbreak, A Personal and Scientific Journey. It's a wonderful book. It's obviously especially good if you've experienced heartbreak, if you anticipate experiencing heartbreak.
If you know someone.
It's good prophylactic. If you have friends who are heartbroken.
Exactly.
Florence, thanks for letting me talk to you about it.
You're so welcome. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you about it now and earlier. So thank you.
That is our show for today. GabFest Reads is produced by Jocelyn Frank, our researcher. It's Bridget Dunlap. June Thomas is managing producer, and Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Follow the GabFest on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. For Florence Williams, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. You'll hear from Emily next month.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.